go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Coming up on this episode of No Script, No Problem, I'll be talking to Deborah Riley Draper, the director of the four-part documentary series, James Brown, Say It Loud. It traces the incredible trajectory of Brown's life and career from a seventh grade dropout all the way to becoming an entertainment legend whose groundbreaking talent and unique perspective catapulted him to becoming a cultural force. Can't wait to talk to Deborah, but first, here's your reality check. There will be no merger between Paramount Global and Warner Brothers Discovery. Warner Brothers Discovery, their shares are down 45% over the past 12 months. Following the release of Q4 earnings, shares sank 10%. Revenue for the quarter was down 7%. And as for Paramount Global, they will reportedly lay off approximately 800 employees in the U.S. and internationally. Not good either. And a recent article came out of the Associated Press addressing this kind of decline in big traditional media companies like WBD and Paramount Global, specifically their cable networks that come underneath both of these conglomerates. So, you know, for WBD, that would be your Discovery Channel, your TLCs. And then specifically for Paramount, is this article mentions MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, BET. And this article refers to quote unquote ghost channels. And I used to do shows for a lot of these ghost channels. It references MTV in particular. MTV's average primetime audience in 2023 was 256,000 people. That is down from 807,000 in 2014, according to Nielsen. That is insane compared to the popularity of MTV in the 90s and the early 2000s. And this next point, I know, and I've seen it before, and it is mind-blowing. On a recent evening, MTV aired reruns of Ridiculousness from 5 p.m. all the way to 1:30 a.m. It's insane that with all the creative minds who want to do programming for MTV, that's all that they can do. That's how cheap that they've become and how lazy the programming is. The S&P Global last week put their parent company, Paramount, on a negative credit watch, citing the deterioration of the linear television ecosystem. And I'm sad to say, because I loved watching MTV growing up, and I certainly as a kid loved Nickelodeon. The troubles also reached to USA, which for the longest time, because of WWE Raw, was kind of immune to a lot of the cable network struggles, despite the cord cutting. WWE is going to Netflix. You know, that was announced. It's a great move by Netflix. USA Network's nightly audience has tumbled 69% over the past 10 years. And AMC, you know, now that Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad, Walking Dead, they've gone. Their viewership has sunk 73%. And even the Disney Channel, they launched Miley Cyrus, Hilary Duff, Selena Gomez. You know, it's the Disney Channel. Little kids love it. Nope. They've lost an astonishing 93% of their audience, from 1.96 million in 2014 to 132,000 last year. That one right there is just shocking, because I didn't realize it was that bad on Disney. I knew that the kids are floating to Disney Plus, but I really had no idea it was that bad. A recent study that I saw shows that 61% of Gen Z prefer user-generated content over other forms of content, you know, traditional media. and user-generated content is followed by music and podcasts, then gaming with TV coming in fourth. And that kind of just shows why these cable nets have become ghosts. But I think that it's bigger than that. You know, there was a decision made by the big companies like WBD and like Paramount Global, as well as Comcast, to go all in on streaming when they saw that Netflix was becoming the streaming king and they thought they could be like Netflix. And they abandoned what made them who they are, which is these, you know, these iconic networks, these iconic media conglomerates. You know, MTV, they were a culture changer. Part of me wishes that there'd be a way to save it, but in 2015, some 87% of American homes had a cable or satellite television subscription, according to Nielsen. Last year, 2023, only 47% of homes subscribed. Now, if you include Hulu and YouTube TV, percentage of homes with access to multiple channels was 62% as of last year. The lack of attention being paid to these cable nets, as well as just the lack of money being put in. I hope somehow someone decides to save these kind of famous brands, but I don't see it happening. All right, now one more thing before I get to Deborah. I went to an AI summit at the Television Academy, and it was really interesting. I produce another podcast called AI Powered by People. And so I'm really fascinated by a lot of the tools that are coming into play, things like Sora, Runway, InVideo, 11 Labs. You know, I dabble with a little bit of everything, even just simple, you know, AI elements to Canva and helping you do your pitch decks. You know, or even enhancing, you know, this podcast, the post elements that Adobe offers. You know, I am certainly not technically savvy when it comes to these sorts of things, but I'm trying to adapt. And so I was excited to see what this offered at the Television Academy. What I was really disappointed by was this kind of overall attitude that it's a suck it up, get with the program, or get off the train, old man type of attitude that every single person that spoke at the summit had. I shouldn't say everyone, a lot of folks who spoke at the summit had. It was all panels, no Q&A. I was just really just rolling out different products for that were out there. It's up to you to pay and use them. And it really felt very disconnected from some of the problems that we are facing and will face. And that was the problem that I had with the whole day. Now, there was one product called Flawless that a filmmaker had developed and was, you know, it is actively now using and selling, that I thought was terrific. It solves the problem of foreign language dubbing, as well as, you know, when you have a bad take, you can actually fix it in post with the permission of the talent. So that was a great piece of AI technology that everyone in the room was excited about. There was an audio discussion, you know, with the people from 11 Labs that was interesting. However, I felt like they should have addressed the whole robocall issue, but they didn't. There was a legal discussion that was certainly important, but I felt like it didn't go far enough. I really just felt like it was a missed opportunity. And I think anybody who's in the entertainment industry is interested in AI, or should be interested in AI, but also should be wanting to have a real discussion about how we use it, what should we use it for, and what's the best way to kind of keep the human involved. Because I think even when you look at Sora, there's still a human being who has to operate that software. We're the ones telling the AI what to do and utilizing it, learning to use these tools better than someone else. That's the key. So I'm all for kind of playing around with these tools. But the biggest thing that I kind of took away from this was no one wants to talk about who's making money from these and how much they all cost, because every single item that was rolled out costs money. And all these people out there that were talking want to make money. No one's really concerned about the effects of jobs. Nobody really cares about anything other than buy my product, use my product. And anybody who says, well, this is great for storytellers, they're full of shit. They want to make money. They want you to buy their product. So anyway, that was my two cents. All right, enough of me talking. Time to get to Deborah Riley Draper. She is an award-winning filmmaker and advertising agency veteran. She is a 2021 Ad Council Champion for Good and a three-time NAACP Image Awards nominee. Her newest project is a four-part documentary series called James Brown, Say It Loud. And you can find it on A&E, the A&E app, Hulu, Amazon Prime. Make sure you watch this thing. This thing is incredible. If you know anything about James Brown, this is the definitive story of one of the greatest musical performers ever. The project is executive produced by Mick Jagger and Questlove. Now here's the interview. Hope you guys enjoy it. Deborah Riley Draper, thank you for being on No Script, No Problem.
Thank you for the invitation. I've been waiting for this all day, so let's jump into it. Super excited. I love this podcast, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Yeah. So, well, congratulations. I just got through episode 2 of James Brown, Say It Loud. I'm like blown away. Like, how much pressure? You're talking about one of the most iconic figures in all of music, really in all of pop culture, the godfather of soul. You got to direct a four-part series on the one, the only, James Brown. So let's just start with, you know, how honored did you feel when you became the director of this series? Start with that. How did you get the gig and how did it feel when they were like, okay, you are the one?
Absolutely. So when I got the call that there was a potential four-part episodic docuseries on James Brown, they said, hey, Deb, are you interested? I'm like, are you crazy? Of course I'm interested. And then I put together a treatment of how I would approach it in the four episodes. And what I love is I looked at this treatment a couple weeks ago, and it is remarkably so close to what I said I would do almost 3 years ago. So I'm honored and proud of that. But when I pitched it and I explained who I was, and I said, I'm Deborah Riley Draper. I'm born and raised in Savannah, Georgia. My daddy was born in South Carolina, raised in Georgia, just like James Brown. I'm a Black woman from the South, and that's what I'm going to bring to this story. I'm going to bring my lens, my POV of understanding very fully what my uncles and my father and my mother loved about James Brown, loved enough that she hopped on a train to go to Harlem to see him at the Apollo with my Aunt Hazel before I was born. That much love. Exactly. So this was a story I wanted to tell. This was a story I wanted to be a part of. And of course, I didn't want to mess it up. That goes without saying. That's a given. I'm not worried about the network. I would have my family to answer to.
Forget
the network. I would have everybody in Savannah, Georgia to answer to if I messed that up.
Yeah.
But it was important to be able to look at a figure for me that represented unfiltered Blackness, that was born during the Depression, tap danced during World War II, you know, cut his first record around the Korean War and rose to prominence during the assassination of Dr. King, lived through hip hop, you know, and President Obama declaring he was going to run for president. That is a life lived. And that's a powerful life lived. It's a life that is truly, I think, one of the best examples of the lived Black experience tied so closely to Black history, tied so closely to American history. And to be able to look at that from being born dead to dying on Christmas Day was going to be the most powerful storytelling of my career. And it was certainly going to be the excavation, anthropological, psychological, social, musical, cultural excavation and unpacking and developing into a story in a way that was through my own lens. Lots of people have told the story of James Brown prior to me, but I wanted to do it in a way that I thought was important. And I wanted to do it in a way that put Blackness in the center of the storytelling, because he put Blackness in the center of everything. And you could hear the pain and the joy in the music. Every yell, every scream, every move, everything is a part of the culture that he experienced, that he brought to it. He had this genius, right? Coupled with a lived experience that was powerful and provocative and nothing like anything I'd ever seen before in my life. So I was all about it.
You said it, the biggest challenge of your career. You're coming off Legacy of Black Wall Street, obviously also a big challenge. When you're looking at the entirety of a James Brown's career, I mean, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1986. He's part of the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He is literally one of the greatest musicians, musical performers of all time. You also have Mick Jagger as an executive producer. Yeah, you have Questlove as an executive producer.
He had just won an Oscar.
Right. So how did you start when they were like, okay, here you go. And you've got all the archival.
I started.
Right. Okay. So talk to me a little bit about your process as a storyteller to go, okay, this is how I want to start to put the pieces together over these four episodes.
Well, you know, after I'd written my four episode treatment and I kind of really broke down the framework based on, I'd done a ton of research already. By nature, I'm a research-driven person. That's why I did Olympic Pride, American Prejudice, Legacy of Black Wall Street. I love being in primary source material. I love to know what was being said when, contextually, who said it and why. So I had so much newspaper, so many newspaper articles, hundreds upon hundreds of hours of interviews. But what jumped out was the 1969 cover of Look magazine. And it said, "Is James Brown the most important Black man in America?" What? That question was the question that I wanted to understand. Like, why was that on the cover? Like, this man, the publishers considered this to be an important cover. And it was a question I wanted to answer. Was he? Is he? And I wanted James Brown to help me answer that question. So in looking at the four parts of his life, the early life, the making of this young man who would get this contract with King Records and literally dust the floor with everyone on the Tammy Show, then the rise of this very powerful man who could literally stop a riot in Boston, and then the post-70s man who's contending with a little bit of faded glory, the emergence of disco, all of the changes in music and entertainment and technology, that guy, and then the icon who literally, his music is the bedrock of everything we hear on the radio. That's how I looked at it. And now I had to go investigate. It's kind of like concentric circles, like, You start with this hypothesis and then you've got to go find, is it true? And it's an investigation. But I wanted to listen to James Brown and I wanted to create a canvas where he could help me, because I figured nobody could tell the James Brown story better than James Brown. That's why you hear so much audio from him, because he was very clear on who he was, what he wanted to do, even when he was wrong, even when he was right. He had a point of view about himself and about the world and how he wanted to move in the world as an entrepreneur, as a singer, as an entertainer, as a songwriter, as a husband, as a father. And then I wanted to find the people who knew things about this. And I spent some time at Morehouse College, and there's some footage of James talking to even students from Morehouse, but it was important for me to understand with David Walrice, Black identity, because that's his scholarship and how it related to James Brown and what he brought to the table culturally and how he dealt with that from a trauma perspective, growing up poor in a house that was very traumatic, growing up in a brothel, being put into an institution as a child. What does that do to a man? What does that do to a person? What does that do to a human being? And how that was both jet fuel and how that, you know, catapulted him, and how that also, you know, was a weight that stayed there at the same time. And that also helped me understand how to approach questions with the people that had this fixed line to James Brown. I wanted to be able to ask them important questions, not just about the music, but questions about the man and the music and how this music made you feel and what this music meant to you, but also what the music contributed. and what the man contributed and what he may not have contributed. So that's how I approached it. And I mean, interviews, I listened to them all, but I also listened to the music because he's an amazing storyteller. And if you listen to even Down and Out in New York City, right, which is from the, I'm a filmmaker, so of course I'm going to listen to the soundtracks of Black Caesar and a lot of the film work he did. But even in that, he talks about being a shoeshine boy. He talks about, you know, what it's like. So these things that happen to him come into his music in such powerful ways. He recalls them all the time. So he's telling us who he is. And I use that to help. That's why you hear a lot of music. That's why you see performance, because it's not just for the performance sake of it, but it's also for the experience of how he's expressing what he's going through in that moment, whether it's grief, whether it's rage, you know, whether it's calmness, whether it's joy, whether it's happiness. And I think that that was really telling for me, the lyrics, reading them, and there's so much storytelling, there's so much autobiographical information in the lyrics, but also watching the performance, listening to those live albums when he talks to the audience and he's sharing things, but also in the studio when like Sid Nathan is telling James Brown how to perform. Really? Come, Sid Nathan, fall back. We don't need you. But that tells us that even James Brown had this power struggle and this power dynamic that was existing with this man that owned King Records. Hearing him talk to Bootsy in the studio and listening to how he interacted with Catfish and Bootsy in the making of Sex Machine, all of this helps us understand him, and it allows him to participate in this storytelling, you know, in a first person kind of way. That's how I approached it.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's brand new day toilet bowl cleaner disinfects both the toilet brush and bowl, killing 99.9% of viruses and bacteria with a fragrance that feels like a tropical getaway for your senses. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Very smart. I love that. I love that plan. A couple things that really struck me, the civil rights kind of section in episode two, the impact of the song, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And for someone like Chuck D to talk about how much that meant to him, where did you know how big of a deal? Okay. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, learning, you know, what that was like for you to learn the impact of that and that phase of his life. And how much of an impact James Brown had.
I tell you, if we go back a little bit before he wrote the song, if we go back to the campus of the HBCU of Tougaloo College at that James Meredith March Against Fear rally, where you see James Brown, Stokely Carmichael, Dick Gregory, Martin Luther King, Sammy Davis Jr. on that stage at that tiny HBCU, and they are there to support James Meredith after he's been shot, you see the beginning of James Brown understanding the importance of his role and understanding what the fight was really about. as he stood there. And that's why, instead of using the performance footage, I wanted to use what he said to those students, to those young Black students at that HBCU. He said, "You may give up, but never give out. You gotta keep pushing." He was really concerned about their progress as students. Don't be a dropout. All of this is connected, because he wanted them to be able to survive this world and to be the very best they could. But he also knew what they were up against. You know, and so from that moment at Tougaloo to the stage in Boston, just hours after the assassination of Dr. King, and his ability to tell the Boston police to fall back and to quiet the crowds, you see the emergence of what Look magazine said, is he the most important Black man in America? And then right after Boston, he did the same thing in Washington, D.C. And then he writes this song, Say It Loud, on his private jet on the back of a napkin. And the song itself is so important, because you have a community and a nation grieving. And he gave us direction. Say it loud. I'm Black and I'm proud. Because hold your head up, your shoulders back, live in your Blackness, and don't be ashamed of it. But the say it loud part is really for any marginalized group, because you have to own your narrative. You have to be strong and courageous enough to say it, right? You have to be able to say it, because the it sometimes is removed. The it sometimes is dismissed. The it sometimes is hidden. So you have to say it and own it, and it has to be loud, because the powers that be need to hear your voice, and you actually need to hear your own voice. And that's what it meant to me. I needed to know that I had my own voice, and I need to be able to use it in these four episodes and forever as a filmmaker and a director, that my voice is important and it can be loud and I can be confident about it and I can say what I need to say and be confident in that. And that's what James Brown was telling them then. And that's what he's telling us now, you know, and to not underestimate the value of what you have to say.
I'm curious what you feel like is the importance of a documentary like this about a figure who, a young person, a Gen Zer may not know, probably doesn't know that much about James Brown. What do you want people to get out of this film? I'm in my 40s, so I remember seeing James Brown in Rocky IV, you know, and getting excited, living in America. Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So I have that memory. And then I remember listening to his other music after Rocky IV. I was a little kid. So my Gen Xers, you know, we kind of have this memory, but then, you know, millennials probably a little, but after that, I bet for a Gen Zer, this is going to be a new, you know, a new experience. Talk to me a little bit about what you want people to get out of this.
I think there are a couple of things. When you look at Live at the Apollo, that is a viral moment. You know, James Brown used the media of the time to make that live album go across not only America, but the world. So he personally wrote letters to DJs, and you see some of the archival letters that he wrote. That was his Twitter. That was his Instagram. He understood branding. He understood how to be an influencer, because he was an influencer. So he was an influencer at the highest level. He could call the radio stations and the DJs and tell them about this new record. James Brown put his face on his records. He knew how to brand his artist himself. He understood marketing, and he understood his social currency very well, and he knew how to use it. The lesson is really about being your authentic self. For his time on this earth, he was James Brown, the guy who was educated only to the seventh grade, born and raised between South Carolina and Augusta, Georgia, a guy that sat in his blackness and took it everywhere he went. He did not code switch, whether he was talking to Richard Nixon or whether he was in the Chitlin circuit. What you got was what you got. And how he came is how he came. And I think that that connectedness that he had to who he was important. And I think what you can't take away from him and what we all can use a piece of is that man had the work ethic. He was the hardest working man in show business, period. You may can do a lot of things better than him. You may be a better accountant. You may be a better dancer. You may be a better singer, but you were never going to outwork him, period. And what you weren't going to do is diminish his commitment to education for Black and brown kids in the South, and period. He really stood by that in such a way that, you know, part of his legacy is this charity that will educate these children. So I think his understanding that education was power, even though he didn't have an education, was really important. And then his confidence and his resilience and his ability to always bounce back, even after the high highs and the low lows, he would always know that he had this God-given talent and this creative genius that he wanted to share. And when he performed, he never shortchanged his audience. If they paid $50, they were going to get $500 worth of show. You know, he believed to give everything he had to whoever wanted it. And I think those are virtues that, irrespective of the highs and lows, I think those are tenets and lessons that we can all benefit. Work hard at what you do. Over deliver to your audience and your customers. And make all your moments viral. I think every generation can benefit from a little bit of that James Brown philosophy.
Yes. Yes, we all can. I wanted to ask you, you know, anyone who tackles a figure like James Brown, or really, you know, in this proliferation of whether you want to call music docs or sports docs, or you're taking on the story of a huge famous figure, whether it was The Last Dance with looking at Michael Jordan, you know, it doesn't, none of these figures that we, you know, we idolize or whomever, none of them are perfect. Yeah. A good friend of mine, Sasha Jenkins, did a doc on Rick James. And he and I talked about how
I love that doc.
Yeah. I mean, it was phenomenal, but he and I talked about how you can't look at Rick James's career and not talk about the bad, you know, the bad stuff. Obviously James Brown had some legal troubles, you know, as well. 1988, he had a, you know, a run in with the police that led to a, you know, he went to jail.
He went to jail
for 3 years, you know, had a gun and a shotgun, you know, into an insurance store. How did you, I would think it's pretty delicate for you dealing with his two daughters, right? As part of the filmmaking process, they were featured prominently.
Yeah.
How did you approach that in terms of, I want to celebrate this man's career, but I also have to be honest about who he was from a 360 perspective?
I spent some time becoming educated on how to have conversations on IPV. I didn't even know the acronym IPV, interpersonal violence. I was not even familiar with that term, but I became educated with the term and how to have conversations with survivors and people who may have faced or saw or experienced domestic violence. So first I wanted to become educated in IPV so that I can ask the right questions, but also so I could approach it openly and honestly and create a safe space for them to talk to me and build the type of trust where we can have that honest conversation and also ask the questions in a way that would not cause harm or that would not trigger a situation that would leave them in a worse place than I found them. And they were very open and very honest. And you'll see that in episode 3. But no, we're looking at a lived experience. And in a lived experience, we talk about, you know, what happened in the 80s, you know, we talk about, we have the footage from the courtroom. We have footage of James Brown explaining what happened in the chase. So that was a significant part of his life. And we talk about that. And we talk about when he was paroled, because the highs and the lows, right? That's human. I don't know a human that's had all highs. I don't know a human that does not. There might be one. I don't know one. I don't know a human that does not have the need to heal some trauma. And there's a lot of unhealed trauma in the world. And James had that. And unhealed trauma creates maladaptive behavior, you know? So we have to look at that, because that's part of that lived experience. That's part of the genius, right? The genius also has flaws. Episode 3, we look at that, and we look at it honestly, and we look at it openly, and there was primary source material to examine.
And I respect that, because I feel like there are a lot of these celebrity docs where a lot of that is kind of glossed over, and many times because the celebrity is an executive producer, kind of drives the story. So I really, really respect kind of just being honest and telling the story.
I mean, how do we learn? How do we learn anything and take anything away if we can't look at if we can't face truth, right? You know, we have to stop erasing history. We have to stop hiding history. We have to face it. There are things in our history, there are things with the idols and the people that we idolize that we have to face and we have to understand, because understanding that not only makes us more empathetic, understanding that helps us all heal and makes us better people. And it helps us not make the same mistakes, you know, because if you learn something and you understand it, you should be able to draw from that and be able to make better decisions for yourself.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
I want to ask you about kind of the state of documentaries now. Been through a pretty rough period. Sundance went a little better. The Christopher Reeves doc, I believe, sold for $15 million to Warner Brothers Discovery, which is a positive sign. There were a couple other sales, I believe, coming out of Sundance. You know, and I haven't watched it yet, but I know that there's a Run DMC documentary on Peacock. I've seen just a couple more that I'm excited to see. As someone who's literally in it, how are you feeling?
I am optimistic, and I'm going to tell you why. Because say it loud, right? Because there are things that we and stories we want to tell, and we want to be able to say it. And I think there's an audience for understanding and unpacking the lived experiences of people and places and things that we want to know more about. And I think there's also, there's a necessity for us to tell these stories, because there's a necessity for us to remind ourselves and remind each other that all stories are important. And I think we're going to see some really big, important stories in the next couple years because we need that. And I think we're understanding what happens when we don't face the music and when we kind of run from it. And I think the documentary filmmakers are going to become bolder. They're going to become stronger. They're going to become empowered. Whether or not the films sell for $15 or $20 million, I don't know. Will they be made? Yes. Will they be great? Absolutely. And will we see a new generation of incredible filmmakers inspired by the work that they'll see in the next few years? 100%. And I think as filmmakers, if we do nothing else, that's what we have to do. Make sure that we've created a pathway so that there can be some other people who have the opportunity to tell stories as well. Tell them differently, tell them better, tell them fully.
I appreciate your optimism. You have me excited. I'm about, well, yeah.
I mean, why wouldn't we be optimistic? We are in the business of storytelling. We are in the business of informing. We're in the business of inspiring. We're in the business of educating. That should never stop, whether or not someone is excited about what we're doing or not. That's our calling, Steve. That's why we're here.
I love it. I love it. Okay. So any Mick Jagger stories? Did any, like you got to sit there and chat with Mick. Any Mick Jagger stories?
Mick Jagger is such a consummate storyteller. What was really fun was I was asking him when he actually first heard James Brown, and it was the Live at the Apollo album. And he was like, it was hard to get, and like only one person in the neighborhood had it, and they had to pass the album around. And I thought that was really funny. I also thought it was really interesting the first time he went to the Apollo. He was like 18 or 19 years old, and he went in, and he wasn't like Mick Jagger like we know Mick Jagger. So he's just like this white kid coming into the Apollo. He's looking around and he like slinks up to the balcony and gets a seat, and he sees James Brown performing, and he's looking down and he's like, oh my God. So he tries to get backstage, which he did. And he's like, hi, I'm Mick Jagger. I'm with the Rolling Stones, you know? And so I love the fact that he looked at James Brown and all of these soul singers with such reverence. And I love that he has become not only a student, but a historian and an advocate for their music and their legacies. And I think that's really important. And I think that's a dynamic way to use your power and your platform. And I'm excited that, you know, he and Questlove, of all of the people that could have directed these four episodes, that they chose me. And that my voice gets to say it loud, and my POV and my perspective, and I get to bring my whole Savannah, Georgia, to this. And I hope the most important thing is I hope my mom and my Aunt Hazel are looking down and thinking about when they were at the Apollo and knowing that, decades later from that moment, that here I am sitting, talking to you, talking about the Live at the Apollo album, having footage from the Apollo and being able to use it in a 4-part episode about someone that they found to be so important to them.
Perfect. I love it. All right, Deborah, thank you so much for joining me on No Script, No Problem.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Take care.
You too. And you can watch James Brown Say It Loud on A&E with the A&E app, on Hulu, and on Amazon Prime. And now I'm going to end the episode on a bit of a somber note. Vernon Butler passed away on February 21st at the age of 47. Way too young, way too early. Vernon was a wide receiver I played with at Washington University in St. Louis. I know, right now you're saying, how could you possibly have played college football? Well, relax, it was Division III. Now, I may not have been that good, but Vernon was spectacular. Vernon was the offensive player of the year in the league. He was a 2-time league first team selection. Vernon ranks number one for all-time scoring with 39 touchdowns and one extra point kick for 236 points. When did he do that? I don't remember that. I'm gonna have to ask my friends about that. But he was a great guy, and he will be missed. He had the biggest smile, the most infectious laugh. I don't think I ever saw him in my 4 years that I was at WashU with him. I never saw him down or upset. He was just one of those guys who lit up a room and made everybody around him happy. And I used to, you know, have to guard him every day in practice, and that was a nightmare. Hopefully I made him better, but he was just a hell of a player and a great guy. The only kind of good thing is I went through all my old photos, and I encourage everybody to do this every now and then, but dug through all my old photos from college. I know I have too many, but it was nice just to kind of, first of all, remember that I was young once, and I, you know, had all my hair and everything, but it was nice to see those faces of folks who I went to college with, and I'm going to reach out to them because you just never know. You never know. He was only 47 and gone way too soon. And you never know. My condolences to Vernon's family. All right. That is going to do it for another episode of No Script, No Problem. For everybody listening, please remember to subscribe, download, and rate the show with 5 stars. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Amazon Music, Audible, and TuneIn. You can also find it at Bleav.com and at Bleav Podcast. Follow me on X, Blue Sky, Post News, at Steve Berkowitz, and on Instagram and Threads at Steve M. Berkowitz. You can also email any questions you have to noscriptnoproblempodcast@gmail.com. If you're interested in advertising on the show, please contact Bleav at Bleav.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Berkowitz for No Script, No Problem.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.